Welcome back to How to Be Queer. This is Chris.
And I'm Callum. And today we are talking with our special guest, Michael, about Asian Heritage Month and its intersection with queerness. So get on board.
We have a couple of corrections. We were, while we were talking during the podcast, a couple of the things we said, we just want to make sure that they are, you know, on record for being correct. So the first correction we want to make.
So my apologies to the history fans out there. Dates are not my strong suit. And so I had incorrectly stated that the first record of Asian Canadians coming, or Asian folks coming to Canada, was in the 1800s. The actual first recorded date we have is 1788. And so that's about 100 years before I said it was. And I deeply regret that mistake because a lot happened in those 100 years. And if you're curious, because you should be, you can find all the information on our stories for this month. We're going to have some ACPI Heritage Month information going up today. Thank you so much.
Beautiful, beautiful. And I also wanted to make a correction. When I said in the news that Raja was the only winner in the drag race franchise that is of Asian heritage, that is not correct, because Priyanka, our very own season one Canadian drag race winner, is of Asian descent as well. And of course, we can't forget the winners of drag race, Natalia Pliakam and Anjali Anand. Little correction I wanted to throw in there.
We just want to make sure you're all starting your weeks with the correct information.
Exactly. Enjoy the show. Special guest Michael, welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
All right. So usually on here, what we'll have you do is introduce yourself. So if you don't mind giving us, you know, your name, pronouns, a couple of identifiers if you want, and also maybe some things about you. Tell us about yourself.
Sure. So my name's Michael. I use he, him pronouns. I think before I like speak on anything, I like to introduce, I like to talk about like where I come from, my social location, so that like anyone who's listening gets a better idea of like what those perspectives are that I'm speaking from. So I am cisgender, I am Filipino, I am Canadian born. My parents are immigrants from the Philippines, and I grew up Catholic, but I don't practice that religion. So yeah, those are some of the areas at which I come from and that I'll probably be speaking to today.
Excellent. Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our next piece is all about queer news. So I can go first. So I love Selling Sunset. I think it is the most ridiculous show ever. And I also like looking at homes that I'll never be able to afford. It's ironically very therapeutic for me. Mm-hmm. So there is one of the people on Selling Sunset is named Chriselle Strauss. And the first season was all about her divorce. And the second season was all about her dating her boss. And now that the second season is over, she has confirmed that she's dating G Flip, who is a non-binary artist. One of G Flip's songs, my favorite, is called Gay For Me. And it's just a great party anthem. But one of the things that I really like about the way that Chriselle came out talking about her relationship with their partner was that she just likes energy. And I just think that's the way that she shut down all of the conversations when people are asking about Chriselle's sexuality and what it's like dating a non-binary person. Chriselle just goes, I'm just drawn to good energy. And that is kind of how it happened. And I just really like that. And I want, Chris and I have talked about this before, we love the idea of no longer having to come out. Mm. And I think when we have people with bigger followings, bigger platforms, becoming aware of their own gender journey and their own sexual identities, I think it's really important for them to push back on the idea of coming out, because it gives all us regular chance to do the same and not get as much pushback from it. So that's my fun and flirty news.
Is G Flip on this show?
G-Flip is not on this show. They met at a Halloween party.
Oh.
Yeah, they met at a Halloween party, and they were both with, like, their ex, like, their partners at the time. And they stayed in touch because I guess Chrishell is really into the music scene and is attending concerts and live shows all the time. And so G-Flip invited her and was like, hey, like, come to my show. And Chrishell went to their show. And within weeks, they started being seen around town. And Chrishell is also in G-Flip's newest music video, which I have to say is very not safe for work. So do not watch it on your work laptops, children.
I promise not to watch it on my work laptop, but I certainly
don't watch it. Yeah, do not watch it on the work laptop.
Mm-hmm. We love a controversial Halloween party.
Yeah. You know what? The queers love a Halloween party. And so it does not surprise me at all.
And we love to make it controversial. Like, why not?
Absolutely.
All right, Michael, do you want to share some news? Do you have news?
Well, I wouldn't say it's queer news, but just like jumping off of what Kellum just talked about. So I saw Simu Liu yesterday, who unfortunately is not part of the queer community.
Very unfortunately.
I think he was on an episode of Selling Sunset or something. I haven't actually watched the show, but maybe I should now. And he was talking about, someone asked a question of like, did you buy the house that was shown to you on Selling Sunset? And he was like, no, I don't actually make that much money, even though I'm a Marvel superhero now. Yeah. So yeah, that's what that made me think of, you talking about that. So that's not news related at all. I think maybe if I had to talk about something news related, like, I don't know if you folks have heard of the Fire Island movie that's supposed to come out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, with a lot of Asian representation in it. So I'm just like really looking forward to that. And it seems like it's really friendship based, which I think is new storytelling for like queer narratives. Like putting that at the forefront, I think is gonna be really fun to watch, especially on a location that's like known for, I don't know, it's gay promiscuity. So yeah, mm-hmm. looking forward to seeing Fire Island. And just another little thing, like Michelle Yeoh is in Everything Everywhere All at Once, and she was recently on the Las Culturistas podcast, which is like a super fun podcast with Bowen Yang. But yeah, I listened to that recently, and I'm like, this is old news at this point, but that movie is really good. And I would just want to encourage everyone to go see it, especially, I guess, during Asian Heritage Month.
Yeah, for sure. That's on my list. I need to, maybe this weekend.
And there is a very prominent queer storyline, and I think that's not advertised.
Okay, duly noted. Chris, what's your news?
Well, my news, a little bit of a hard left, but it's not really that hard of a left because it's still entertainment. But all of the cast of All Star 7 for RuPaul's Drag Race was on The View either yesterday or the day before, or like the day before that or something. I don't know. It was this week. And they were talking about All Star 7 and also some queer representation on the show, which was really cool because the host was like, okay, Monet Exchange, how do you feel about all of the like legislation that's coming out right now? And then Monet Exchange was talking about how it's like people are just, queer people specifically, are so much more visible now than they ever really have been. She was just kind of like, I mean, look at, we're on The View, like this is pretty major. And so there's a lot of backlash happening, but we're fighting, there's more fight in us and we're more visible than we have been before, which is nice. I also kind of want to keep it a little bit light by saying that Shea Coulee had this purse that was on the show. And one of the hosts, I think it was Whoopi, was like, oh, can you please like show us what's in your purse? And she was like, okay, absolutely. And she was like, I drew this picture of Whoopi Goldberg, and it was this fabulous, fabulous picture of Whoopi Goldberg that she actually drew. And she drew it when she was 15. Her mom told her to mail it to Whoopi Goldberg, and Whoopi Shea was like, you know what, I'm going to give it to her in person. And so she actually gave it to her in person when she's like 30. So it's awesome. That. I'm very excited about that. I guess also knowing that it is Asian Heritage Month, Raja is going to be returning to All-Star 7. And she's actually the only Asian American winner of RuPaul's Drag Race, and she's going to be on it. So that's kind of cool.
Raja was so underrated. People really slept on her, I think. And she looks amazing in all of the promos. I'm so excited to see how she turns out.
Oh my God, me too. I'm so excited. Raja was one of my favorite winners, and I can't wait. I'm so excited.
I'm one of those people who slept on her.
That's fair.
At least you can admit it.
Yeah, I was fully there for Manila Luzon.
Obviously. Oh yeah, Manila too. Yeah. Oh, what a good season.
Yeah.
I honestly think that the fans should get to pick an All-Stars one year. I feel like that would be so fun.
Oh my God, what a concept.
So that Jujubee can come again.
Yeah, exactly. We need Jujubee.
Jujubee would not. I genuinely don't think. People would be like, okay, Ju, you had your time. Juju, I think
Jujubee would totally come back. What are you kidding?
I feel like I'm the only one who's like, Jujubee, your time is up. Thank you.
Yeah, no, it kind of is. Yeah.
We need more. We need more Jujubee. I will never get enough Jujubee. I will never. There's no such thing. I don't know what you're talking about.
The limit does not exist.
No.
The limit does not exist.
So we are chatting about Asian Canadian Heritage Month, also Asian American History Month and Pacific Islanders Month in the States, or in most of the states, I should say. And so we are going to chat about a little bit of the history, a little bit of Michael, your experience, and then also just have a little bit of a discussion, specifically because COVID has been really hard on the Asian community. I know we've seen it in Toronto. I know it's been highlighted kind of for the last 2 years in the news. So we want to be aware of the history, and we also want to be aware of the present day situations that have been occurring. Just a little disclaimer, when I'm speaking about specific communities, I'm either going to be saying Chinese, Korean, Japanese, Canadians, or I'll be saying Canadians of Japanese, Filipino, Korean descent or heritage. Anyone has any questions about that, they can throw it in our stories after we release this episode. Asian Heritage Month has been celebrated since the 1990s in Canada, unofficially. And in May of 2001, it became a designated Heritage Month, which we have quite a few Heritage Months in Canada. Sometimes they overlap. And so May is Asian Heritage Month and has been for the last 21 years, which, can I just say, it is nuts to think about the fact that 2001 was 21 years ago.
I just want to talk about this for a sec, but like the World Trade Center event was in 2001 as well. And every single one of my students from now on will not know what that is. And it's just weird to me because like they're all in high school, like literally the grade 12s don't know what it is. It's wild. Yeah, okay. They weren't there.
So it feels like it was so long ago, but it actually really wasn't so long ago that we've been recognizing this month. And I also want to point out just a little bit of history for my history fans. Asian Canadians have been around since in the 1860s. Now, it's also important to write, to note that majority of history textbooks are written by white people, so especially in North America. So chances are there were folks coming to Canada very early, and much earlier than we have written down in the history books. It's also important to note that majority of these folks weren't coming here by choice. A lot of them were brought here to work. A lot of them didn't have another option that was palatable for them. It was, you're coming to work with us, or we will continue to colonize and potentially harm and oppress your people. Well, definitely oppress, but potentially harm your people. And so quite a few of them, of Asian Canadians, were brought over specifically for projects like, and this is one that Chris, you can call me on because you're an educator, but the only historic reference I remember learning about was the Canadian Pacific Railway. And that was, I love trains. I'm a huge train kid. And so I have this very picturesque ideal of what working on the railway was. And the history book sold it to me so beautifully. And it was like the Japanese people came over and they helped to build the railway and we all lived, and it is not the case at all. And so, Chris, are you able to speak to kind of what that looks like in the education system?
Well, I mean, in the history curriculum, we do want to acknowledge the actual history that was happening. And for the most part, they were kind of being sacrificed in order to build the railway, like in order to go through certain mountains or in order to go, you know, they would have to use explosives. And those explosives were not necessarily as safe as we know how to do it now. But, you know, in that case, what was happening was they were being sent in to put the explosives in and then would run, but wouldn't necessarily get away from it. And so a lot of people, a lot of Asian Canadians died in the construction of the Canadian Pacific Railway. And so it's a very tragic part of our history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so with that, I want to kind of put the first question to Michael, is with your parents being Filipino immigrants to Canada, what did they have? Did they have any opinions when you came home from school learning or not learning about kind of the Asian heritage in Canada? And did you folks ever have those kinds of conversations?
Ooh, good question. No, like flat out, no, we didn't have those conversations. I think my mom came, oh gosh, around the early 1980s, I think, when she was still maybe in her early 20s. And I think like once I was born and started school, it was just like, you need to like succeed in this like new environment and just like, and do like, yeah, do well. So just listen to your teachers, do the assignments that are being asked of you and don't really like question the material that's there. And also like, what's my mom gonna know about the education and the curriculum that's being offered here? And then it was something I just like never thought to question or talk about with her or with like any of my family, because like a lot of my family is here and I grew up with them while I was like in the first few years of elementary school. And it was just like, yeah, no, this isn't, there's nothing to question, just kind of consume the content and do what's asked of you. I think those like critical thinking skills aren't maybe encouraged in elementary school, especially like back when I was in elementary school. So yeah, did not think twice about it. Even in high school, didn't think twice about it.
That's fair. I don't even know that I would, like thinking back to, you know, learning that there were Japanese internment camps. I didn't really understand what an internment camp was. And so, you know, knowing like now having friends who are of Japanese descent or of, you know, just Japanese descent because there were Japanese internment camps, specifically because of World War II and the alliances between Japan and Germany. Knowing Japanese Canadians now, they were, some of them were far removed from, you know, the Japanese, like they might've been second or third generation Canadians, and they were sent to these camps anyway. And they were in a completely different place than where they had grown up. And like, that wasn't taught to me. I just kind of thought like, oh, they were put into like, you know, places that were, you know, just to keep them safe until, until the war was over. And the gravity doesn't really hit you sometimes when you're a kid. And so I totally understand that. Being Filipino, how do you feel? Is it different from maybe some of the experiences? Like, I'm not saying that you have the experience of being Japanese or Chinese or anything like that, but how do you feel that the Filipino experience is unique within Canada?
Oh, man. How do I even talk about this? It's kind of complicated because like sometimes we're not like considered under the Asian umbrella, like with census surveys, like we get our own category, like you'll see an Asian category and then you'll get like a Filipino one specifically. And then, so it's like, which one do I choose? And I didn't know I was different from just being Asian. I think because of our location, like the location of the Philippines, it's like they didn't know to classify it as like Southeast or South or whatever. But I think in the more recent years, it's become more clear. And so, yeah, along that journey of, I don't know, society learning how to classify it, I feel like I was also on that same journey of like, ooh, am I gonna have that specific category available to me? Or am I gonna have to like slot myself into one of these more generic ones?
It's interesting.
Yeah, I do wanna add, like sometimes I would just choose other because I didn't know. And then I would just like write in Filipino.
Because this podcast is all about how to be queer, and to myself as a white European settler, that to me, that sounds so similar to what it could be like for a young person who's part of our community, where you don't really know how to classify yourself. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering, how did your identity come into play with your heritage?
Ooh, but yeah, in terms of like my sexual orientation, there's a bunch of things I didn't mention when I gave my introduction. Like, first of all, I didn't say I was gay. And, I also come from like a single parent, low income family. So that factored into my sexual orientation. I was recently talking to my partner about this, but it was like, I didn't think to come out because I didn't think it was ever going to be possible to like meet another gay person in like these low-income neighborhoods I was living in. Yeah, I just didn't think it would be a possible lifestyle. And like, I was under the impression that I wasn't going to claim this identity unless I was able to actually like do the behaviors, like be able to kiss another guy, for example. I was like, so that's never gonna happen. I'm never gonna run into any gay people. I'm never gonna date or get into any relationships. So like, I'm just gonna like keep that to myself until the opportunity somehow, some way happens. So yeah, I wouldn't say I was so much like repressing it, but just like, it was just sitting there, like on a shelf, like ready to be let out once, if ever that was going to happen. I don't know. It's really weird to think about and explain.
I think I get it in a way where it's like, there, when you don't have that representation, what really is the point of coming out if you don't know what the opportunities are out there? I mean, all we're chatting about this just before you jumped on, Michael. It's really hard to find information about prominent queer Asian Canadians.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine what it was like as a young person, especially in a neighborhood that felt physically distant from that possibility, but also the emotional distance of not being able to see someone who looked like you, someone who identified the way you did in media, in television, even, you know, at the grocery store. So how did that really, I know you're close with your mom because I know you. Mm-hmm. So what was that relationship like when you did choose to come out and share that part of yourself with the rest of us?
Our relationship, has always, oh God. I want to say generally it's a good relationship. There's obvious, you know, parental child tension. But yeah, we're very tight. It's almost like a brother sister relationship because I can tease her a lot. And so even the way I came out to her, while like there was still all that turmoil of like, we come from a religious background and like she might throw me out. I kind of knew deep down that like, no, this was going to be okay. So yeah, I just told her, at this time I came out as bisexual, and I was like, so you know how I like girls? And she's like, yeah. I'm like, I also like boys. And she's like, I knew that. And I was just like, oh, okay, great. And then, yeah, I was like lying down on her bed too when I told her this. So it was just a very like cute, precious moment. And she was like on the computer doing something, like half paying attention to what I was saying. But yeah, and then moving forward from there, is really the same. I would just get those random texts of like, be careful, like, you know, HIV AIDS is like a real thing, so be safe. Prior to that, it was always just like, oh, like, make sure you have condoms and stuff. But now the messaging changed specifically to HIV.
Yeah.
I get it. You know, she's from that old school mentality where, and she came here during the 1980s when, like, you know, the HIV epidemic was like still very much happening, or the effects of that. And so, yeah, she just wanted me to take care of myself. And since then, yeah, it's been cool. Like, all the relationships I've had, she's very welcoming. And sometimes I think she likes my partners more than me. Yeah.
Love that. I feel like that's a fear of mine as well. I feel like my partner, especially now, is getting along with my family so well. And I'm like, every time I visit, they're like, where's Ray? Why isn't Ray here? I'm like, hi, you haven't seen me in 3 weeks, but okay.
I don't know if you've heard of the model minority myth. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So for those who are listening and don't know what it is, if you've heard of it, could you explain it? ? Or would you maybe be okay with, I can explain it too, but I don't want to.
Got it, for sure.
Okay. Okay. So, what is the model minority myth, and how have you been affected by it, if you have been?
Mm-hmm. So basically comes out of, rooted from racism, that like you can rank marginalized communities, and Asian people, those closest to whiteness, are at the top. So that's, yeah, Asian people at the top, for example, and then with the Black community like at the bottom, and that the Asian communities are experience a lot more privilege because of this model minority myth, you know, that we can get more jobs, like more employment opportunities, and any type of privilege that you can think of, like we will experience it. We are academically more inclined, so we'll succeed in those settings more. Yeah, it's all about the proximity to whiteness. I feel like I'm explaining this so badly because my head is still a little congested.
I feel
but
you.
Yeah, if there's anything else you wanted to add, Chris?
No, I would say that the things to be specific about would be just like the fact that it's like you're the model, right? Mm-hmm. For like the proper type of person, the proper type of minority. And the thing to emphasize would just be that it's a myth, yeah. Right? Like there's no reason to believe that.
Yeah, and that we're more silent too. And more likely to, what's the word, like, assimilate into white culture versus just like living out our own culture. Yeah, and so I've definitely gotten the like, oh, you're supposed to be like good at math, right? But I always think back to when I was failing math in grade 9 and I had to get a tutor, and it was like, I'm supposed to be good at this. But then you really feel that impact when the expectation is like so high and like I'm failing. And like I knew a ton of like Asian people who were doing badly in school. And it was like, yeah, how do they all feel? Like we're supposed to be succeeding and getting all A's and being on honor roll and dean's list and stuff, but that's not always the case. And like, you know, these marginalized communities, like we're not monolithic, like we're very diverse within those communities.
So it would have put like maybe a lot of undue pressure on you to really be successful, and then when that wasn't necessarily met, you know, it may have caused some inner turmoil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just for me, I try to avoid the turmoil and just reflect more so is probably the word I would use. I try to like just let those things kind of fade to the background, just to, for my own sake, to keep those boundaries up and make sure like I'm really rooted in my own self rather than the expectations that society's putting on me. But this has been like a learned thing, and also just from the strength that like I think I've gotten from my mom is like, be your own person and like don't let these expectations of anyone really affect how you're living your life. So yeah,
I think it's interesting that you are kind of like, you were talking about the social construction of race without actually like kind of like identifying it completely, because like saying that Filipino is its own category and not part of Asian, you know, descent, like Asian itself used to not be a category. Asians were white. And so like, why, I don't know why that changed, but it did. I don't know the specifics right now, but like that, that kind of fluidness kind of happens. And so because of that, I'm assuming that that's part of the reason that Asian becomes the model minority. But then when you think of Asia, it's huge. And so like, India, for example, is part of Asia, and you know, they are not necessarily treated as, you know, as a model minority, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even how like Filipinos specifically like wear a little bit darker skin tone, so that has also made me think about like, okay, I'm not like at the very top of this model minority thing, so I kind of feel, yeah, in terms of like colorism, like how that affects me, and like the things that are said in Filipino culture too. Like we live in the Philippines is located somewhere very hot where the sun is shining a lot and people get tanned very easily, but it's like, oh, make sure you don't stay outside so that you don't get so dark. And it's like, what? No. I've kind of taken that on and just been like, I don't care. I am going to spend all the time in the sun, which I'm going to do after this.
Good.
Because I like feeling tan. I love my brown skin.
We love to hear that.
It's beautiful.
I am wondering, and Michael, you and I had the privilege of working together during the onset of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And so I know we have very similar stories from very different perspectives. So I'm wondering if you would be able to share a little bit of what you saw in the Filipino community when, you know, we did see that rise in anti-Asian hate, if you saw it affecting the Filipino community, and then maybe how, again, because of that othering that has happened for you as a Filipino queer person, as a gay man, and also seeing the LGBT Asian community, if you saw a difference in the way that those communities were treated during the beginning of the pandemic.
Honestly, from the relationships I have, the people I know, I don't think there was a lot of that experienced, thankfully, but I think it was something we were always thinking about could happen. And just like hearing about how like the truck convoy was possibly gonna go through Chinatown, for example, like that was scary to hear about. And like one of the jobs I have is with Asian Community AIDS Services located in Chinatown. And one of my colleagues was like, I'm not gonna go out and try to be around that area for like a few weeks because the truck protest was happening like multiple weeks. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it more so the fear, I think, is what I was hearing than the actual like acts of violence. But then that was very prominent in like the States. And mm-hmm. so the news was being brought to us like via Instagram and stuff. So there was a lot of online content that was like, this is what's happening around the world. It's really dangerous. Please be careful. Yeah, but then I was also thinking about how like Filipinos are what, like, I don't know if we're number one or number two in terms of the amount of immigrants that are in Canada. So it just makes me think like, there's so many of us here, like, how can this be happening? Like, I feel like everyone must know at least like one Filipino person at this point. And yeah, it's so like disheartening to just know that happens when it's like, there are so many of us to the point where we're not minorities anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, like that's not the right term to be using because there is such a large population of different communities that exist.
Well, it's interesting. I don't know that we should maybe go into some like whataboutism or whatever, but like I know that, for example, with the onset of the war in Ukraine, Ukrainians have a huge diaspora in Canada. And like there are so many Ukrainians that everybody knows a Ukrainian person. It's the same as, you know, with the Filipino community. There are so many people who are Filipino here. And so like, how is it a minority? It's not really. But the contrast between that is kind of stark, right? Like, there, I don't know that if there were a war to be happening in Philippines, that they would get the same kind of sympathies that the Ukrainians would.
Yeah, I obviously wouldn't know for sure, but I would say my vote would be they wouldn't, because we also have seen wars waged against the Palestinian people. We've seen people, and you bring up Palestine and Israel to anyone and no one wants to talk about it, because
for many reasons. Yeah. The one, I mean, obvious difference is that Russia is threatening nuclear war. So I get it, but like, also there's been a huge outpouring of love. And I know that like the Philippines has gone through turmoil in the past, and it's not like we've been this outraged, but anyway, I don't know if you wanted to speak to anything like that, Michael.
Oh gosh. I feel like the country's just in such a state of a hot mess, like it has been for the past few years, because of who the leader has been and who the new leader is now. Honestly, I don't want to talk about it too much because I don't know all the information, but I myself during this pandemic have really appreciated that land and want to visit it, but at the same time I don't want to because of the dangers that are happening. So
would there be dangers to specifically you as a queer person to visit Philippines?
Honestly, like possibly, but maybe depending on like how outwardly queer I am. But I also know that, you know, it has a drag community. It has that existing like gay community, queer community in the main cities. Yeah. Also big stars who are like trans identifying. So it's like, it's impressive to see from here. I don't know what it's actually like over there. It would be interesting to experience. Yeah.
I know that there's a Drag Race Philippines coming. I'm very excited about it.
Two different versions. Yeah.
Yes. I just did a quick little Google, and apparently the Philippines has been ranked one of the most gay-friendly nations in the world.
That's awesome.
And is the most gay-friendly space in Asia in a survey of 39 countries. Philippines was the 10th most gay-friendly. Interesting. But it is still... all of the notes on this thread basically say like there's still legal challenges that folks face, specifically around identification and the law, basically. But 10 out of 39, I feel like that's pretty good.
It's hopeful. I mean, it could be going through the same type of like turmoil that like Canada's going through, right? Like it's not that it's a huge amount of turmoil, but like obviously I don't necessarily feel safe every day. And we do have protected rights. So like maybe it's similar in Philippines.
Okay, well, that is the end of all of our questions. Michael, the thing that we love to ask people as they leave the podcast is, what would you, kind of in like a RuPaul-esque moment, not like, I don't have a picture of you when you were younger.
Oh, no.
I don't. I thought about it. If you had the opportunity to say anything to a young Filipino LGBT youth, What would you say?
Oh my gosh. You know, that segment makes me cry all the time. And I recently got into my PhD program and I was like writing out this message, and it's like, what would I say to my younger self? I never finished the message because I would always start crying. That doesn't happen right now. But I think just knowing, yeah, like you have a supportive family, you have a supportive mom, that's going to help you like, oh, okay, that's specifically for myself. But if it was like for another young person, just that the representation, it might be hard to find, but it's there. Like sometimes you have to do the work yourself. Like put in the work yourself, but it's there, and the landscape is changing. There's authors, there's celebrities like singers and actors where you'll find that inspiration. There's online communities that are safe and have that representation, and just really that like the landscape is changing and the conversations are changing, and there's more room for intersections of identities to exist. Like there's so much potential and opportunity. I hate to say like, oh, you just stay positive, but but like that is kind of the message that I would say. You know, like we, Kellen, like we were able to work in an LGBTQ specific organization. I never thought that was going to be possible, but these places, while there's still not too many and they're all located in Toronto, but they exist. And it just takes a lot of work to like be able to be wrapped up in those communities and just like feel that love, but it can happen.
I think it's a good message of hope to end us on.
That's beautiful. Well, Michael, you are officially a friend of How to Be Queer, and we would love to have you back eventually. So hopefully you are welcome. What I'm trying to say is we want you back. Please come back. We have enjoyed this conversation very much. Is there anything else that you would like to add to this podcast that you feel like you didn't get to say?
Oh my gosh. Okay. I do want to say that like I just came off of all of my COVID symptoms, but I have like bad seasonal allergies, and that just really like messes with my way of thinking and speaking. And plus combined with my nerves. So I don't know how this is going to turn out, and hopefully your editing is amazing.
Chris's editing is,
thank you so much for just being like flexible with the timing and for having me and for this fun conversation on this beautiful Saturday afternoon.
It's been beautiful.
Thank you so much.
I look forward to, I probably will reach out again to like promote my PhD study, but
yes,
like a bit from now.
Yeah. Okay, good. Yes.
We 100% hear it. Support and celebrate your PhD. I'm so here for it. I cannot wait till the day I get to call you and be like, hello, doctor.
So gosh. Yeah.
Be beautiful.
All right, Michael. Well, get out and enjoy that sunshine. Thank you so much for your time today and sharing your experiences with us.
Awesome. Thanks for having me. Enjoy your very beautiful weekend, the two of you.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye.